Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls California Election Special. Every Wednesday until Election Day on November 6th, Your Call will host a special second hour at 11 a.m., I should say the day after Election Day. We've done a lot of shows on very important races and propositions, and you can find all of those at yourcallradio.org. We also got word that California's voter registration has hit an all-time high. According to the Chronicle, 19 million people are now on the rolls. That's about 76% of those eligible to vote are registered. That's great. If you are not registered, thanks to the conditional voter registration process, you can actually register to vote in person, even on Election Day. And hopefully this will take off across the country at a time when so many states are suppressing the vote. Here in California, we're making it much easier for people to vote. And if you want to find out if you are registered, you can go online to voterstatus.sos.ca.gov. That is voterstatus.sos.ca.gov. It's just really important to make sure that you're registered and to double check on your polling place so there's no problems on Election Day. So today we're going to talk about the state propositions that could decide the future of so many issues. Rent control, it could set aside almost $9 billion for the largest water bond in the state's history, and also repeal the gas tax, which could eliminate road repair and transportation funding. But there are many more propositions that are not getting much media attention. And joining us to talk about propositions is Ben Christopher. Ben is covering the 2018 election season for CalMatters, a nonprofit journalism venture committed to explaining how California state capital works and why it matters. Hi, Ben. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, isn't it great news that California's voter registration has hit an all-time high?
Yeah, indeed. I guess people are pretty excited to vote this year. I imagine a lot of that has to do with what's going on at the federal level. People are interested in all things Trump and Trump-related, but I think also it has to do, like you were saying, with the reforms that California has passed to make it easier to register.
And Ben, are you hearing of any problems that we should be aware of about voting? Like, you know, we're going to do a show about voter suppression, what's happening in Georgia and North Dakota and so many other states. But are we having any problems in California with registration?
So as far as I know, we're not having any suppression issues, but we are having some issues that are coming to light now about the California's Motor Voter Act. This was a law passed that makes it so that when people register for a new driver's license, that they'd automatically be registered to vote as well. And there have been some hiccups along the way throughout the summer as that's been implemented. And so we've seen some issues with people being registered for the wrong party or being registered to vote when they're not legally able to vote because they're not a citizen, for example. There's no suggestion that there's actual intentional fraud going on here, but there is it's a bit of an administrative hiccup, and they're putting a hold on the motor voter process for the moment.
Right. So again, it's a really good idea to find out if you are registered, just to make sure everything's in check. And that website is voterstatus.sos.ca.gov. And be sure to spread the word and also let people know who are not registered that they can register to vote in person, even on Election Day, which is so great. And I wish we had this across the country. Hopefully one day we will. So, Ben, you all at CalMatters have been doing a great job of looking at the propositions. You've got a very easy guide called California Ballot Measures. And if you want a quick guide, you can watch the videos. All the props are explained in less than 1 minute, but you also do a good job of summarizing the props. And I wanted to chat with you about some of the really important propositions that are not getting as much attention, for example, as Prop 10, which would repeal Costa-Hawkins and allow local governments to implement rent control. That's getting a lot of attention. We did a show about that. Let's talk about some that are not getting attention. For example, Prop 5, which is the portable real estate tax break. This is really important. There's a lot of money being spent on this. Tell us about Prop 5.
Sure, yeah. It's a little bit wonky, it's a little bit complicated, but as you say, it's really important. So this builds on California's existing convoluted property tax rules. As some of your listeners might know, back in the late 70s, California passed Proposition 13, which kind of fundamentally changed the way that property taxes are implemented in California. So what it means is basically when you move into a house, when you purchase a house, the property taxes that you pay on that house are determined based on the price that you pay when you buy the house. So, for example, if you bought a house in 1980 for, let's say, $100,000 somewhere, which you couldn't really find anywhere in California now, you'd be paying a property tax based on that $100,000 value today. It'd be allowed to go up 1% every year. But basically, the longer that you stay in a house, the bigger the property tax savings you get. But the problem is that if you've been living in a house for a very long time and then you want to move by purchasing a new house, then you would have to have your property taxes reassessed for that probably more expensive house. And so Prop 5 sort of fixes that problem. If you see that as a problem, it allows older or disabled homeowners to take a portion of their lowered property tax base with them when they sell their home and move. So basically, rather than, you know, there's this feeling that people might be kind of trapped in their home, so to speak, if you own a house in, say, San Francisco that you bought a long time ago and then you want to move, you can't afford to pay the higher property tax bill. Or you don't want to pay the higher property tax bill, and so this would allow folks to do that. It would allow them to do that regardless of whether they're moving into a house that's of higher value or lower value. It would allow them to do it as many times as possible.
And let's talk about those who are for and opposed. So CalMatters has a great guide, and then VotersEdge.org also has a great guide. This is a relationship between MapLight and the League of Women Voters. And what they did is they also followed the money. And so if we look at Prop 5, the total amount raised, $13 million. This is Yes on 5. California Association of Realtors, $10 million. National Association of Realtors, $3 million. And then No on 5 is just under $3 million. You've got the SEIU, $1 million, California Teachers Association, $750,000, American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Lots of nonprofit organizations oppose Prop 5. So yeah. Lots of money is being spent on this one.
Definitely. I think maybe a cynical take would be that the realtors have an investment here to make. These are the folks who help people buy and sell homes, and Prop 5 would, in theory, make it easier or less costly for people to buy and sell homes. And so they have a big interest in making sure that this goes through. So the California Realtor Association are the folks who really got this going, and the Chamber of Commerce, other business groups are also behind it, as well as the California Republican Party. But against it, there is also a lot of money on the line, because this would effectively, according to the Legislative Analyst Office, which is the nonpartisan fiscal analyst for the state, this would cost local governments and school boards about $2 billion a year in lost tax revenue. And so that's why you have a lot of local government groups against it. You have a lot of public sector unions against it, as well as the California Democratic Party.
Okay, and so that is Prop 5, real estate tax break. Lots of money on that one. Another one that is receiving a lot of money but not getting much attention is Proposition 11, which is a paramedic break time.
Yeah, this is one of those propositions where voters might wonder why they are being asked to vote on this. But basically, it has to do with how break times are regulated for private ambulance services. So this would basically give private ambulance companies the permission to continue to require EMS workers to remain on call during their meal and rest breaks. So in other words, when they're on break, when they're having their lunch, they would still have to have their radios switched on. So the backstory here is that a couple of years ago, the California Supreme Court ruled that security guards cannot be required to keep their radios on when they're on break. So in other words, the idea is that a break is a break, and you can't have someone be on call all the time. And that ruling was very specifically tailored to the security industry, but a number of private ambulance firms were, you know, worried that this might soon be applied to them as well, applied to that industry. And in fact, they are now facing class action lawsuits in California courts over over break time violations, and they could be on the hook for millions of dollars in back pay and penalties. And so, sort of while that's moving through the courts, the private ambulance industry decided to get in front of it and put this on the ballot to try to sort of carve out an exception in labor law for the industry.
How would this affect the workers? Because if you read this, it's sort of, you know, it allows private ambulance services to require medical service employees to remain on call during meal and rest breaks. And so I'm wondering if people are thinking, well, if they don't remain on call during meal and rest breaks, what happens if they get calls?
Yeah, so I mean, the argument that you'll hear from supporters of Prop 11 is that, you know, emergency medical workers are, you know, they're emergencies right in the title, so they need to be on call, you know, whenever something happens, and that if this were to pass, they would be required to hire additional workers to sort of make up the difference. But yeah, I mean, in terms of how it would affect workers day to day, this would simply allow the current practice to continue, and also there are, you know, concerns that for those who are party to the class action lawsuits, that they would not get those you know, penalties or feedback.
But they're already on call, right?
Right, they're already on call.
Okay. And so let's talk about, there's a lot of money back in this one from the American Medical Response.
Almost, yeah, surprise.
Almost $22 million.
That's right. Right. So this would be the industry who would be subject to the new labor laws should it be applied to their industry. So they have a giant vested interest in making sure that they can continue with current labor practices and that the Supreme Court ruling is not applied to them.
And do we know what's the average pay for some of these workers?
You know, I don't know that off the top of my head. My understanding is that it's not particularly high, but I don't have a specific number.
And the no side has not raised any money. And according to some sources that I've seen on Facebook, people who actually work for these companies, they're pretty angry at their union because there's no argument against Prop 11. And they said that the union dropped the ball and didn't submit an argument against Prop 11.
Yeah, if you look inside the voter ballot or the ballot guide that the many voters get in the mail, there is no argument that's submitted. So, yeah, I mean, it goes to show that you know, in a lot of cases, the ballot is used to hash out some really important issues of public policy that's relevant to the state as a whole. But in some cases, you might have a situation where a private interest group, whether it's in this case the ambulance industry, or you might have the realtors, or you might have a labor union, who use the ballot as a way to sort of hash out a very individual singular issue that's relevant maybe only to them.
So at the end of the day, this would basically lower the costs for private ambulance companies.
Well, it would allow them to maintain their current practice. And so it would not increase their costs, I guess.
Right. And so what's also interesting is those who are in favor, a number of newspapers, the California Republican Party is also in favor, and then those opposed, the California Democratic Party, the Green Party, the Libertarian Party, SEIU, and the Chronicle is one of the only media outlets that's opposed to it, according to VotersEdge.org.
That's right. So I think a number of people are swayed by the argument that regardless of sort of the private interests involved of the people who are supporting this, that the current practice is the best way to go, that you know, EMS workers should be on call just because, you know, they're in the business of responding to emergencies. And so that maybe is why you have a lot of editorial boards, and certainly the Republican Party is on board as well.
A former union worker wrote a piece on this for Mission Local and said the proposition is aimed at shielding the Colorado-based American Medical Response Company, known as AMR, from more than $100 million of potential liability in pending and future lawsuits and $100 million in increased costs if AMR has to add employees to cover drivers during their lunch breaks. Even the hefty amount the company has thus far spent on pushing Prop 11 is dwarfed by what the company would otherwise be on the hook for.
Yeah, that's right. They're clearly spending a lot of money on this for a reason. And again, if the courts decide that their current practices are not consistent with California labor law, then certainly they're going to be on the hook for potentially penalties, and also they're going to have to spend a lot more hiring additional workers.
All right. So, again, that is Prop 11, paramedic break time, a very important prop that's not getting that much attention. And on today's Your Call, it's our special California election show. Today we're talking about state propositions. A lot of money is being spent on these props. We're talking about it with Ben Christopher. He covers the 2018 election season for CalMatters. And Ben's going to be with us for about 10 more minutes, and then we're going to switch gears and really dive in and follow the money. So if you have any questions about propositions, if there's one that might be a little confusing, because in many cases they're intentionally written to be confusing, we will go over them and look at the facts, what they would do, what a yes vote means, what a yes vote doesn't mean, and then how much money is spent on these propositions. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Here's another one that's not getting that much attention. Proposition 12, bigger cages for farm animals. In California, we tend to get a fair amount of propositions that would affect animals. Mm-hmm. What would this one do?
Yeah, so this, if it sounds like deja vu, the voters voted on a similar measure in 2008. That was Proposition 2. And this would sort of, in a way, double down on that. This would place specific size requirements on chicken coops and cages used to contain pigs and cows on farms in California. And actually, it would be applied to any food or animal products sold within California. So, in fact, this would be applied not just to California farmers, but farmers across the country who want to sell eggs or pork in California. And so this would, the specific dimensions would be, one square foot of floor space for each hen by 2020, and then cage-free by 2022. And then there are, specific size requirements for pigs and calves as well. So the backstory here is that in 2008, the state voters passed Proposition 2, and that was a similar initiative which required that farm animals be allowed to stand up and move around and turn around, rather, in their cages. And after that passed, a number of commercial egg farmers argued that that does not actually require them to go cage-free, and so this is sort of I suppose you could say it's clarifying the point by saying, no, in fact, by 2022, clearly written into this proposition, you have to go cage-free for egg farmers. The debate around this is really kind of interesting, because the proponents of this and the folks who wrote this proposition of the Humane Society of the United States, and they actually got some buy-in from some groups within California agriculture, so Central Valley Eggs, for example. They also got the support of the California Democratic Party. And the anti-side, the people who are against Proposition 12, it's a pretty weird coalition. On the one hand, you have sort of predictable arguments that it would raise the cost of doing business in California, or raise the price of food. And so you have that argument from the California Republican Party and from a lot of agricultural interests. But you also have the opposition from PETA and from the Humane Farming Association and these other animal rights groups who argue that, no, in fact, the California voters in 2008 said we want to go cage-free, and that's the rule, and so we shouldn't give farmers additional time to meet that requirement for 2022. So the politics of this are a little bit confusing.
Hmm. And some animal groups also say that this, at the end of the day, it might be a bigger cage, but the animal almost will be killed anyway. And so they say it's kind of a false, it kind of paints a false picture to citizens about how animals are treated.
Sure, that's absolutely right. I mean, at the end of the day, we're talking about calves and pigs who are being bred for slaughter. So if you're opposed to that across the board, then certainly This is not even a half measure.
Right.
But you know, in the past, you have animal groups like PETA who have been on board with these kind of more incremental steps. But this, I believe, is they consider too incremental.
Right. So the Yes on 12 side has raised almost. Wow, $10 million. $3 million from the Open Philanthropy Action Fund, the Humane Society, just more than $2 million. A couple individuals, the Humane League, Mercy for Animals, they've all raised some money on this. The No side has raised $566,000, and that has all come from the Humane Farming Action Fund.
Right, and again, those are animal rights activists. So it is kind of interesting that even though you do have opposition from big agricultural groups, again, the bulk of the no money is coming from animal rights groups, which you wouldn't necessarily expect, given that this is being branded as an animal rights initiative.
Right. Okay. So that one is Prop 12. That's Prop 12. Yes, and we made a mistake. We said 11 props. There's actually 12 props.
Well, no, actually, there are 11.
Are there 11?
It's Proposition 1 through 12, but 9 is missing.
Some
voters might find that confusing, but there was initially a measure, and some people might remember this, that there was a proposal to divide the state into three parts. We're going to have three Californias.
Oh.
And that was Prop 9, but
that's
then
right.
a court ruled that no, actually, voters can't use the ballot measure to destroy the state of California, so... that was taken off.
Well, we have other important things to vote on.
Exactly.
Well, all right. So another one that's not getting much attention but is very important is Proposition 8, Dialysis Clinic Profit Pruning.
Yeah, this is another one of those measures that you could kind of argue is an example of a couple different interest groups sort of hashing it out through the ballot initiative process. So on paper, what this would do is that this would require companies that operate dialysis clinics throughout California to effectively cap their profits at or profit margins at 15% of their business costs or above their business costs, and so any payments that they receive above that profit margin, they'd have to pay back to insurance companies or individuals who pay for dialysis treatment. So effectively, it's a profit cap for this industry. The backstory here is that the vast majority of dialysis clinics in California are owned by two for-profit companies. There's DaVita Kidney Care and Fresenius Medical Care. And for years, the Service Employees International Union and United Healthcare Workers, the union that represents a lot of healthcare workers in California, have been trying to unionize the workers within this industry. They sponsored legislation. They've floated other ballot measures as well to require higher staffing ratios. And so this is sort of the latest gambit. I mean, their argument is that these companies have a giant market share, and so as a result, they're able to sort of cut corners at the expense of patient care. So their argument is pretty straightforward that, you know, these companies are extremely profitable and they need to make sure that they're not putting profits over the quality of care, and to sort of force them more to invest more in equipment and training and in their employees. But obviously there's a large contingent of folks who are against this measure, not least of which include DaVita and Fresenius, the two companies who are the target here, who would have their profits paired so considerably. And so they've actually poured the No campaign has I believe at this point over $100 million. That's by far the most expensive proposition on the ballot, even though it seems like kind of an obscure issue.
Yeah, this is amazing. DaVita has spent $61 million and Fresenius has spent $28
million. Yeah, it's massive.
Wow.
And so it gives you a sense of how profitable these companies are and how much they would stand to lose if it's worth it to them to pour that much money into this initiative, I think.
And again, Ben, just to repeat, CalMatter says what Prop 8 would do, it would require companies operating dialysis clinics to pay back any profits over 15% of qualifying business costs. Okay, can you, what does that mean exactly?
So basically, it would say that, you know, for any revenue that they take in, payments from insurance companies or payments from whoever's paying for this, for dialysis, anything that is over 15% of their costs, they have to pay back. So basically, the, you know, the profit being the difference between how much they take in and how much they spend on costs, the profit can only be 15%.
And why are they getting more money back? Like, why are they getting more? Why are the companies operating these clinics getting more profits?
Why are they getting profits over 15%?
Yeah, profits over 15%.
Well, I suppose dialysis is a you need it if you need it, and so and also private insurance tends to pay fairly well for dialysis treatment. And these two companies have a giant market share, so I guess you could argue that it's not a particularly competitive industry, although I'm sure the two companies would argue otherwise.
And so then the payments would be made to back to the insurance companies or to the individuals who pay out of pocket?
That's right, yeah. So this would not necessarily go, I mean, most people, when they get dialysis, they get it through their insurance, either private insurance or if they're on, you know, Medi-Cal or some sort of public insurance program. And this would require these companies to pay back any money that they receive over the profit margin to the folks who pay them, which is typically insurance companies, although public insurance would be exempt. So this would only be going back to insurance companies or individuals who pay out of pocket, but not too many folks pay for dialysis out of pocket.
And according to California Healthline, the number of Californians who are getting care at dialysis centers has jumped in recent years. It's because people are living longer with end-stage renal disease. More than 139,000 kidney patients sought treatment at dialysis clinics around the state in 2016. Wow, this is a rise of 46% from 2015.
Yeah.
So how would this affect dialysis patients?
Well, so that kind of depends on who you ask. You know, the pro side will say that, look, these companies are raking in way too much profits, and by reducing their profits or capping their profits, it would force them to spend more money on boosting care and on increasing capacity, and that would improve care for patients. But the counter argument that you hear from opponents of this measure is that that this would actually make it much more difficult for these companies to remain in business. They might have to close clinics, and that could, you know, obviously at the end of the day, put the lives of thousands of Californians who need dialysis in jeopardy, I suppose, if particularly in rural areas who maybe aren't particularly well served by lots of clinics like these.
Well, we got a message from someone who said, I'm still a little confused on this. So here's another description from VotersEdge.org. Prop 8 would limit how much dialysis clinics can charge for treatment. Clinics would be allowed to charge for the cost of providing direct patient care and quality improvements, plus an additional 15%. Every year, clinics would have to report how much money they made, what they charged patients, and how much they spend on providing services. If clinics charge more than they are allowed, they would need to pay the money back, mostly to patients' insurance companies. Prop 8 would also prevent clinics from treating patients differently based on the type of insurance they have. Okay, that's really important.
Yeah, so sort of a side issue here is that there was the argument that proponents of this bill have argued that, or this measure have argued that dialysis companies have been sort of funneling patients towards private insurance by helping to sort of pay their premiums or giving them other incentives, and that's because private insurance pays quite a bit more than Medi-Cal or other sort of public insurance rates, because those, you know, Medi-Cal is such a large insurance provider that it's sort of able to negotiate much lower rates. And so that's sort of a side debate to this whole otherwise very complicated debate.
Yeah, well, this is a really important one. So here's the money. You always have to follow the money. Yes on Prop 8, $20 million. SEIU, California spent $1 million. The California Democratic Party has spent money. And then on the no side, wow, almost over $100 million. As we said, DaVita Health Care Partners, $61 million. Fresenius Medical Care, $28 million. U.S. Renal Care, $7 million. Dialysis Clinic, $1 million. I mean, Ben, this just shows how much these companies are making. I mean, this is massive money. In fact, I think this may set records for California props, because the last time we set a record, if I remember correctly, was the proposition that would have allowed the California commissioner to basically tell health insurance companies that, no, you do not have the right Blue Shield to raise premiums. And the insurance industry spent $40 million on that one. Well, this one is $100 million. I think this might be the highest one in our history.
You know, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but that certainly would not surprise me. And certainly it's the most expensive of any measure on this year's ballot, which is interesting because I think, again, you know, as you've been saying throughout this program, so much of the attention is on Proposition 6, the gas tax, or Costa-Hawkins repeal of Proposition 10. This, you know, I'm sure if you ask most people what Prop 8 is all about, they wouldn't know.
Right.
But the amount of money that's being poured into this really tells you something.
It really does. And it also just speaks to the importance of voting, because there's so many important issues on the ballot this year. And again, if you're not registered in California, and luckily so many are, we're hitting all-time highs. We've got 76% of those eligible are registered to vote. But if you're not registered, you can register on Election Day. There's amazing guides. I know it's overwhelming because we get bombarded with flyers, but there's so many great guides out there that'll help you. Maybe even have an election party to go over all of this stuff with your friends and family. You can register even on Election Day, so be sure to spread the word about that. All right, so that one was very, very important. Another one that's important that's not getting much attention is Prop 7, especially for those of us who are not looking forward to daylight savings time because it gets really dark at 5 o'clock. Tell us about Prop 7, daylight savings time forever.
Yeah, as that's coming up, I think that's going to be a lot of people's front of mind for a lot of people. So this is a bit of a weird one. It's if passed, it would allow the legislature, the state legislature, to pass a law to repeal daylight savings time or move to a sort of a different system not making us move the clocks back and forth every spring and fall. The hiccup here is that it would require the federal government to also give the state approval to do that. And so it's not as if this passes and all of a sudden daylight saving time is abolished or made permanent, but it would be one step in that direction.
And so, for example, we have to fall back next month. If this passes and the feds gave it the okay, then we just wouldn't fall back?
It would allow the legislature to work out a replacement. So whether we move to permanent daylight saving times and then we wouldn't fall back, yeah, that would probably be the way that they would go.
Okay,
so again, that assumes that the federal government would give us a waiver in very short order, which
right.
I don't think anyone's predicting.
Right. So then it wouldn't get dark at 5 o'clock next month.
Right.
The groups that are no on 7 are mostly media, San Francisco Chronicle. Oh, and the California Labor Federation. I wonder why they're opposed to this. Do you know?
You know, I haven't spoken to the folks from the Labor Federation specifically why they're object to this, but I think the overall arguments are, well, there are a few. One is that this is potentially pointless because it won't actually do anything absent permission from the federal government. But I think more importantly, it would be potentially quite inconvenient. I mean, obviously, resetting our clocks is also inconvenient, but it would potentially be inconvenient if California was on a completely different time schedule from the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. It might make things a little bit complicated for trade or communication. And then there's the question of, you know, do we want to have a situation where in winter folks are getting up in the dark and kids are going to school and you know, going to school when it's still, you know, pitch black out at 7:30. And so there's a safety concern as well.
Right. And so the groups for it, California Democratic Party, Republican Party, Green Party, and Friends Committee on Legislation of California. Well, Ben, I know we have to let you go, and I just want to say thank you so much to you and everybody at CalMatters, because you all have done excellent work on this election, and you did a great job of explaining these propositions. So thank you for your time, and thanks for your work.
Oh, thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Ben Christopher is covering the 2018 election season for CalMatters, a nonprofit journalism venture committed to explaining how California's state capital works and why it matters. They do really great work. I hope you can check out CalMatters. And also, if you want more information on props, KALW News Cross Currents is doing on the website at kalw.org. You can find their explanations also of the propositions, what it means if you vote yes, what it means if you vote no, and those are election briefs. Now we are going to switch gears and follow the money. The amount of money raised for the midterms has already surpassed $3.9 billion, which is another record. And voters across the country will decide on the future of the U.S. Congress. California plays a very significant role in shaping control of the House. According to Rolling Stone, California is home to 10 or more swing seats, nearly half of the 23 that Democrats need to recapture the House in November. Joining us to talk about money and politics in California is Daniel Newman, president of MapLight, a nonprofit that reveals the influence of money in politics. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, I want to thank you also because VotersEdge.org, the ballot guide that you put together with the League of Women Voters, is just amazing. I think we use it on every single show. So thanks for all the work that you're doing there.
It's our pleasure. And as your listeners may know, you go to VotersEdge.org, you type in your street address, and it tells you who's on your ballot, even down to the local level, the city council, school board, and judges as well.
Yeah, and it's fantastic information. And, you know, Daniel, the way that things are these days, unfortunately, is you just have to follow the money with everything. And in some cases, that can really determine the way you vote. I mean, I'm so glad we did the show today because I just didn't know that the Prop 8 dialysis prop, I mean, the no side has spent over $100 million. Do you know, is this a record for ballots in California?
It's not a record.
I mean, for props.
Been some, but it is a very high one. And we see that here you have an interest. The kidney dialysis provider would be limited in fees, and they're spending an enormous amount of money to try and block this measure.
Is anything else stand out for you, just in terms of how much money is being spent on the propositions?
I think the Prop 10, which is the one that would allow local cities to have their own rent control laws, is a large money one, also due to the financial interests. On the yes side, you've got $20 million so far, with the largest funder being AIDS Healthcare Foundation, but on the no side, you've got three times as much, about $60 million from realtors and property developers who obviously are opposed to rent control laws.
Right. The numbers have gone up since we did a show a couple of weeks ago. Again, Prop 10 would repeal Costa Hawkins and allow local governments to implement rent control laws. So as you said, the yes side, the group that wants to repeal Costa Hawkins for more rent control, has spent about $20 million. The no side, almost $60 million. And California Association of Realtors is at the top with $5 million. Blackstone Property Partners, they bought a ton of housing after the 2008 crash. $5 million. Western National Group, another $5 million. So there's a lot at stake on this one and so many others.
There is, and that great guide that the government sends you in the mail that explains the propositions, unfortunately doesn't have the up-to-date or any money information, and so sites like Voters Edge and others will have that. And I found that these propositions, obviously there's so much to learn, and going to the Voters Edge site and looking at the money in favor and opposed can really shortcut voter decision-making and have you decide whose side are you on, basically, in terms of the supporters and opponents on the funding side.
And you all at MapLight also unveiled another great tool to track money in politics, the California Political Money Tracker. Tell us about this project and what we can find out about individual candidates.
Yeah, so on the you go to the maplight.org site and you can see the political money tracker, and it shows you, you can look up any candidate that you want that's running for state office. So you look up Gavin Newsom, candidate for governor, of course, And you can see his support right now totaling about $43 million.
Wow.
And one of the neat things about this tool is it puts together the money that's given to Newsom's campaign and also the people spending what's called independent expenditures, which basically means unlimited money in support of him. And his primary opponent, John Cox, raised about $18 million so far.
And I'm just searching for Gavin Newsom to come up with some names here. Oh, this is interesting. So support for Newsom is $42 million. Opposition to Newsom is $17 million. Top contributors, California Democratic Party, $120,000. Greenspoon, a lot of these things I've never heard of. United Health Group, United Food and Commercial Workers. So you've got that. And then you also do the top independent spenders, which is really important.
Exactly. So the independent spending is really the unlimited spending. So you have groups and individuals that can spend an unlimited amount in support or opposition to a candidate. And those are really driving a lot of races right now in Congress as well as the state.
And the top independent spender for Gavin Newsom is Citizens Supporting Newsom, sponsored by labor organizations and Blue Shield of California, $5 million.
Right, so a labor and health insurance group, and then you can go in and type in the name of that group in the state website and drill down further if you want to.
What strikes you about some of the House races in California and how much money Republicans and Democrats are raising?
Well, so without having the exact figures in hand, it's really the competitive races obviously drive most of the spending and most of the fundraising, and the what's really different since the last 8 years, since the horrible Citizens United Supreme Court decision, is that you have corporations and individuals spending unlimited amounts to influence politics, and it's especially problematic in the so-called dark money groups, which is groups that don't have to disclose their donors and have been a big factor in all the close congressional races over the last few years.
10 seats are at play in California, nearly half of the 23 that Democrats need to recapture the House in November. And according to the LA Times, in the top 7 most competitive House races in California, Democratic candidates raised a staggering $21.6 million over the last 3 months. By comparison, Republicans running for those seats took in $4.2 million. That's a huge difference.
It is. And I think, you know, even though these numbers are large, it's really hard to get a sense of what they actually mean. I mean, elections are really inexpensive compared to how important they are for people. I mean, we're going to spend, as a country, much more on Halloween than we are going to spend on the federal elections this year.
Oh, jeez. But Daniel, when you look at the money, I mean, at the federal level, according to Open Secrets, we've already hit about $3 billion just for the midterms, which is a record. And,
yeah,
you know, a lot of people, actually, I'm sorry, $3.9 billion. And people are really just tired of the amount of money that's being spent on elections.
So the real issue is not so much the money being spent, I think, but where it comes from. And right now, overwhelmingly, corporations and very rich people are providing most of the money.
Mm-hmm.
Unions also contribute, but they're a modest factor compared to the very rich people contributing to super PACs and the corporate donations. Now, so what's needed is public funding of elections or voter-owned elections. And so in Berkeley, for example, the voters last year, in 2016, resoundingly passed a matching funds program. So now if you're a candidate for office in Berkeley and you opt into this public funding system, if you decide to limit your campaign contributions to only $50, then every dollar you raise is matched with another $6 from a city fund. And so what this means is that you don't have to depend on special interests. You don't have to spend your time calling people on the phone asking for big donations. You can go door to door. You can have grassroots events, and you can raise all the money you need from small donations. So it's not so much the amount of money that matters. It's where it comes from.
What strikes you about where the money is coming from for California elections?
So it's, I think it's corporations are the dominant player, business interests, and unions also a factor. One of the characteristics of California that's really different than federally is that corporations can give directly to candidate campaigns, which I think is shocking and terrible, but that's the way it is. So right now, so Chevron, for example, can actually donate directly to state candidates, and they do.
MapLight recently joined with NBC Bay Area to look at oil and gas interests and their members to find out how much money they're contributing to political campaigns. And this sector, according to your joint investigation, you found that the oil and gas industry has contributed $182 million to California political campaigns since 2001. What about this campaign season? How much is that industry spending on elections?
So I don't have those numbers at hand, but one of the characteristics of the oil and gas industry, as many other corporate interests, is they give to many candidates, and they give to the political parties. And it's a way of buying influence and access that unfortunately is not available to you or me or your listeners. And that's the problem with the with the system here, that where candidates have to go hat in hand to these big interests, is that it really shuts out the public. And we pay for our representatives to represent us, the public, and we pay for the whole government. But because we're not paying for the campaigns, it's kind of like paying for the sports car, but let the lobbyists pay for the key. You know, we, the taxpayers, are paying for the government, but by not publicly funding campaigns, we're letting the lobbyists drive away with the car and tell where the government's going to go.
And now, at the federal level, the oil and gas industry tends to give a lot more to Republicans. What does it look like in California?
So they give with Democrats being in power, they give to Democrats and Republicans both, and I think that's common in special interests, in that they're giving to who has the most power.
And then, according to your analysis, they have also given $112 million to ballot measure campaigns, $9 million to state candidates, and $61 million to other California political action committees.
They do, and Chevron is the largest contributor in that group, with others like BP, Area Energy, ConocoPhillips also playing a major role in political spending.
And what is the best way for people to search if they want to find out which industries are giving to which candidates and which propositions?
So you can go to the Voters Edge site and look at the particular proposition. You can go to this great site called followthemoney.org, which has historical data on industries as well. And you can go to a tool that MapLight built on the California Secretary of State site, and that's called Power Search, and you can search there as well.
And then can you give us an update on efforts to take money out of politics in California?
Yes, I think so. There's several cities in California that have public funding of elections, and so it's getting candidates that are funded by citizens instead of special interests. So I mentioned in Berkeley was this system which now the 14 out of the 16 candidates for Berkeley City Council this year are running without special interest money. It's all from small donations thanks to this voter-owned elections programs in Berkeley. There's consideration of this in Oakland. There's also consideration of strengthening the systems in Los Angeles and San Francisco to have this as well. And I think that if we're ever going to have a government that actually represents the people instead of the special interests, we need to have campaigns that are funded by small donors and not by big donors.
Will voters be voting on issues that will affect money in politics?
There's none that I'm aware of that come to mind just now. But one of the things that, due to past successes of voters demanding more transparency, is that this year the TV ads for ballot propositions will have much better disclosure about who's funding the ad. So instead of this tiny, unreadable, cryptic print that you used to see in the past, it'll be in clear, bold print identifying the top three funders of ballot measure ads. And then Governor Brown has just signed into law something called the Social Media Disclose Act, which means the ads you see on social media as well will have much better disclosures.
Ah, that's the first time. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. And it's a hope, too, that with California doing this with more transparency, it'll force it across the country as well.
Is there anything else that stands out for you when it comes to money in politics, Daniel, that we need to know about specifically on the California election?
I think it's that it's important to support candidates who are talking about what they're going to do to fix our broken democracy. I mean, it's so obvious at the federal level, but also at the state level with these with campaigns that are just dominated by big money spending and independent spending. And I think that voters can read the voter guide that the government sends in the mail. They can go to votersedge.org to read candidate statements as well and look for candidates who really make that part of their message and are likely to do something about it.
Gavin Newsom spending and raising a lot more money than John Cox. Do you know where Newsom stands on this issue, on money and politics?
I don't. I mean, many politicians, especially on the Democratic side, give some verbal attention to this. But I think the real issue is he going to prioritize it as part of a campaign and as a central platform in his campaign? And I haven't seen that so far, but time will tell.
Well, hopefully, if we're able to interview him, we can ask about that. Well, thank you so much for all of your work, Daniel. And again, the websites, you've got a couple of different ones, votersedge.org.ca. That's where you can type in your zip code and your ballot will basically show up. And then you can see a description of the measure. What happens if you vote yes? What happens if you vote no? Who opposes it? Who supports it? And also, you can follow the money. And then the other California guide, that one is, if you just go to maplight.org, you will find the California Political Money Tracker, highlighting money in politics.
That's it. And I hope that all your listeners will actually take the time to look at who's funding some of these candidates and campaigns, because it can really help inform your decision.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Daniel. Thanks for your time. Thanks for your work.
My pleasure.
Daniel Newman is president of MapLight, a nonprofit that reveals the influence of money in politics. And you can find links at yourcallradio.org. Again, if you'd like to find out if you're registered to vote and make sure that everything is in check, the website is voterstatus.sos.ca.gov. And if you or someone you know is not registered, you can actually register on Election Day. So let's hope we have huge voter turnout. I also wanted to mention that Senator Dianne Feinstein and Kevin DeLeon are meeting for their first debate/conversation. It's going to start at 12:15, and you can watch it online. It's conducted through the Public Policy Institute of California, ppic.org. That is just in about 15 minutes. It's their first conversation. We're going to have Kevin DeLeon on the show next Wednesday at 11 o'clock. We're still reaching out to Dianne Feinstein, but we have not heard back from her office. So we'll keep you updated on that. And if you have any questions for Kevin DeLeon, please email yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Laura Wenis for line producing. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.